You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 9th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Gillian DeBias, and Emma Nelson.
Coming up on today's programme, from the eternal mysticism of A Thousand and One Nights to one man's devotion to the restoration of his family's home, we'll be talking about the astonishing breadth of Middle Eastern literature. Also ahead...
We'll be hearing this and other tracks, which are the choice of today's music reviewer, Linda Mariano, from Triple J Radio in Sydney. And Justin Bergman will tell us what we can be getting up to this weekend in Singapore.
There are so many music, film, and performance festivals happening over the next month. Singaporeans are really spoiled for choice.
And to coincide with the festival here in the UK, we'll explore the rise and rise of Polish cinema.
Oh my God, ich hatte Angst, dass uns kaum essen!
Kobiety. Niemkę. Frau Kwiatkowski, jej córka zostały negatywnie zweryfikowane.
So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24.
But before we launch ourselves into all that, Gillian, how's your cultural week been?
Oh, it's been quite good. I escaped. It was a little drizzly and I decided to escape in my lunch hour. I went to the Serpentine Gallery in the middle of Hyde Park. And I always love the Serpentine Gallery because it's surrounded by trees, really sort of London experience. But it's this period, almost like conservatory. And inside this great sort of always curation of contemporary art. So it was a nice thing to do in the middle of a work day.
It is an amazing space, is the Serpentine, because you just drive past it when you're driving through Hyde Park. And yet, if you took a little time, you find a beautiful place to go. I must confess, I've never been entirely happy with anything I've ever seen at the Serpentine. And I think that's a question that needs to be explored another day. But the idea of the Serpentine itself is just blissful. This intimate, friendly place in the middle of the busiest city ever.
And I love the idea that whether it's on a Sunday, you can take a stroll in the park, you can take your kids. And then, you know, you can dip in. It's small enough that literally you can dip in, have a real curious experience, whether you like the art in there or not, a wonderfully curious experience. And then before you go out to have your tea or coffee, they have the best bookshop and the best magazine shop in the world.
What was on display this week?
This week, well, it was definitely a cabinet of curiosities. It was a Swiss artist called Rosemary Trockel. And rather than her art, she sort of curated things that appeal to her and attract her. It was very bizarre, everything from a period 1912 film of dancing beetles to knitted woolen things. Bizarre. But, you know, always interesting to walk through some rooms like that.
And I can think of no finer way of spending a lunch hour. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. We head to the Middle East next. Because while we start our today's show in London, we are, in effect, travelling to the Middle East and our carrier is Buxt. The region has a rich tradition of writing and of publishing as well, more often than not mirroring the political unrest and complex social history of the times.
And we have in studio the perfect person to discuss this with us. Carol Corm is Monocle's Beirut correspondent and also founder of her own publishing house, Daria Press. She launched Daria in 2012 with the hope of bringing a fresh and positive eye to publishing in the region. Carol, welcome.
Hi.
You know, we all know that Lebanon has such a rich tradition in publishing. We mentioned that, as in the region. How does your new publishing house, Daria, hope to sort of carry on that tradition?
Well, I hope to print, first of all, print books in Lebanon. As you mentioned, we've been printing a lot. First encyclopedia in the Middle East was printed here. Most of the books, there's a famous saying that says books are written in Cairo. They're printed in Beirut and read in Baghdad. Now the Middle East is a bit different. There's much less translations of books. People read less. It's true. So Daria Press hopes to kind of be a window, kind of an easy entry into books for people who might not necessarily read, you know, heavy literature. So it will be guides. It will be books about design. It will be books about food. Kind of a easy and positive window on the Middle East and maybe beyond.
You say people read less in the Middle East. What's contributed to that, other than, is it just the normal way that the world is going? Or is there a mind shift there?
It's difficult. I don't want to generalize. I don't want to say Arabs don't read. But, I mean, there's less of a culture of the book. Maybe not in the Levant, but, I mean, if you go to the Gulf countries, there's no books. There's no bookshelves. People aren't that curious about books. They watch TV. They go out to malls. But there's not. You don't grow up with books around you, with magazines. So it's not something natural.
I don't want to wish to go into too serious a subject too quickly, but I'll touch on it very briefly. I interviewed a woman who had written a book about sexuality in the Middle East a few days ago, and I said to her, who do you hope your audience will be? Because, of course, it has great immediate interest to a Western audience who, you know, will find out something that they have never had access to. And she said, if I can get my book through the censors, it will be all right. And she just sort of seemed to resign to the fact that that might not happen.
Yeah, that's a serious problem. I mean, even when I wrote these guidebooks, I had to go talk to the censors. I mean, and really? I'm promoting. I'm just doing promotion. I'm not talking too much about politics. And when I did the guide on Damascus, we really just focused on the positive things a few years ago. But we still had to go through the censors. And everyone has to do that. Movies, plays. And it's an issue. It's a serious issue.
So what are, I mean, as a publisher now yourself, you must be following a lot of the writers living in Lebanon, but the writers maybe outside the Lebanon writing about the Arab world. What are some of the authors you've been following with interest?
I mean, the Lebanese authors are quite interesting because they're doing, they basically have a civic role that the state or schools are not really filling in. So they're helping the society, like artists, kind of get to grips with the war, with different coexistence, tolerance, history, these things. So the authors are really interesting and they really put their fingers on things that no one else does. So unfortunately, they're not greatly read. It's quite niche. It's very Beirut-y. But, I mean, they're there and that's great. And now there's an Arab Booker Prize, which is kind of reviving things. And it's in Abu Dhabi because they're funding it. But it's great. They're doing writing kind of, what is it, writing seminars for writers, inviting people to go write for a few months and then they publish. Also focusing on translating these works, because that's also a serious issue. It's like, I mean, ask someone in Europe, have you Middle Eastern author? No one knows. They're not really translated. And it goes to the both ways. Mm. Also, and this is a personal thing as a publisher, I find Arabic books, the covers are horrendous. They're like from the 80s. They're really, really bad.
Like?
They're just like ugly pictures, the
retro
colors, dated. Yeah, there's no effort. And I mean, sometimes it's great works and the covers really don't do it justice. You don't want to pick up the book. You really
don't. We have here two of your books, one the Damascus Guide and one the Beirut Guide. And it just looks as if so much thought went into making these different, making them stand out. It's almost like, wallpaper is unfair. What is the
Damascus Guide? I was inspired by it was stamps, Syrian stamps. It's the background of Syrian old stamps that I used. Oops, sorry. As a kind of pattern. It's a bit not a wallpaper. You're right, but it's just a. It's also inspired by the tiles. Yeah. Because it's a sensual experience. You want people to pick up the book, and that's a problem. The Middle East people don't care about books. So it really has to look beautiful for people to want to open it.
I was going to ask you, who is this aimed at? Because if you say if you're having to look elsewhere, who do you want to buy a book?
Well, both. I think locals are always interested. Also, you know, there's a dearth of telephone books and things like that in the Middle East. So guidebooks are useful, even if you just want to know the telephone number of a restaurant. So for locals, it's useful. And for visitors who want to know a little bit about the history, the cultural anecdotes, the famous Orientalists who visited, those kind of things, it's all in there.
Let's move on to a book which I think would probably be the right place to start, given the fact that it's possibly the oldest. It's a new translation of 1001 Nights by the author Hanan al-Sheikh. It is an astonishing book. I started reading it late last night, and as a result, I'm deeply sleep deprived, because it's a book that everybody thinks that they should have read, and yet I don't know anybody who has read it.
That's very true.
This heritage involved in this book, and yet this lady has come up with a brand new translation of it.
Yeah, and this lady is a great Lebanese author. She really, if you want to start, if you want an introduction to Middle Eastern history, I would really recommend Hanan al-Sheikh. Her books are excellent, they're easy to read, and they really put their finger on the issues. And this rewrite of 1001 Nights is the same. You open it up, and the stories are maybe from more than 1,000 years old, and yet they're so what people experience today. You know, the woman whose brother's in prison, she goes to the Qadi, she's like, please release him. And he's like, well, maybe if you spend the night with me, we'll see what we can do. And then it's the same issues today, where you have to go give a bakshish, where you have to know the guy who knows the guy who knows the guy. So And she writes very well, very simply, very, very, very touching. And she really puts her finger on things. So do read Hanan al-Sheikh.
It is quite an astonishing translation. Insofar as she's kept the simplicity of the tale. Yeah. You know, the premise that the king will kill, he will sleep with a virgin every night and kill her every morning. And then, of course, Shahrazad goes along and enchants him with these stories and as a result survives. She said that it was the reason why she went to the book to retranslate it was because it was part of her culture, yet it was lost.
It's true. I mean, I think also lots of Middle Easterners, if you ask them, have you actually read the book? A lot haven't. I think maybe it's the same here with some big classics. I mean,
everyone knows the story, but no one's actually read it.
And so she rewrote it in a very, very modern way. It's just great. Just read it.
It's very simple. It's very beautifully, simply, neatly delivered. It's absolutely wonderful. It is a perfect bedtime book.
It is.
Absolutely
and
perfect.
I mean, yeah, you just dip into it because it's these short stories of smart women tricking men.
And more, and much, much more.
There's you know, a wealth of wonderfully written fiction, but because the region has been so tumultuous, there are a lot of books coming out from journalists, from Arab journalists, from journalists who've worked in the region. I think you have a few there that you feel are quite interesting, in each in their own way.
I think also as a journalist, people are a little bit tired of the kind of macho, seasoned Middle Eastern or big reporter that wants to tell you how brave he is. And these books that I picked out are they kind of explain the Middle East through another angle. Whether it's a personal story, whether it's through food, whether it's through going after your ancestors. And they're all, I mean, they all explain, they sum up the situation in the Middle East, which is super complicated, where people are tired of hearing about it. I, as a Middle Easterner, I'm tired, so I can understand Europeans must be very sick of it. And so the first book is Nahla Ayed's 1,000 Farewells. Who's a Canadian reporter, and she wrote the story of her career and her life, which is really incredible, because she started off in Winnipeg, and then her parents, who are Palestinian, thought that she and her brothers and sisters should kind of know their culture, so they sent them back to Amman, and they lived in a refugee camp for 7 years. I mean, it's pretty tough. So I was reading that.
I spoke to her a few months ago when she came into the studio to talk to us about it, and I said, how do you feel towards your mum and dad as a result of that? And she said, yeah, it was quite complicated
at the time,
you know, being, because she'd gone from a very, very, and the book beautifully explores the fact that she'd gone from this very amazing, lovely, normal Western life to suddenly finding themselves just without any of the structures around them that had survived, that had surrounded their childhood.
But what I found was interesting is at the time when she was, 13, returned to Canada, she did sort of in many ways resent that. But then there was the pull back, the need to understand the stories of the Middle East and the Arab world, and also understand that it's not just one voice, it's not just one story. And she, as a journalist, she always got frustrated when she'd be asked by, senior producers, what's the mood on the street? What are people saying? What is the Arab world saying? saying. It's like, well, it depends who you talk to.
What's going to happen in Syria?
There is that thing that you mentioning a moment ago, Carol, the idea of journalists' books on the Middle East being quite macho. And you mentioned a little moment ago about the idea of Orientalism, of treating the region as the other that everybody talks to. And then you get someone like Nala who comes along and she bridges that immediately. And that's a lovely way. I mean, are we seeing the Middle East and journalists within the Middle East now opening up the region themselves?
I think people are a little bit tired of that whole macho view on things. Or also there's this other strain of all this, like, books about sexuality and women in the Middle East. It's like that's all there is, the hijab and sexual, and the girl that was married when she was 14. And I mean, this is true and it exists and it's terrible. But I find in Europe, you kind of get those two big currents. Either it's the macho journalist or it's the stories about the girls that were abused. So Nahla's book is great because, first of all, she sums up like really complicated issues in one sentence. You get it. And she's smart, she's witty, she's not pretentious. It's a pleasure to read this book.
But beautifully written. And I think we forget that a lot of these journalists, they cover the war zones and they have to be quite concise in how they cover it. But they're writers at heart and they're exceptional writers. And I think when you then put them in the book form, you know, they have a license to really, you
know. But some work, some don't work. Some get dated, some are convoluted, they want to... So this was great. So Nahla's book was great.
Very, very briefly, because I'm afraid time is running out on this, Carol. Can we just briefly mention a book by Anthony Shadid? You said the New York Times journalist who was killed last... Well, he died last year in Syria, didn't he?
Yeah. This is the
fusion that we've been talking about throughout the last few minutes, which is the macho journalist who actually writes a book about building a house.
Yeah. So Anthony Shadid was... I mean, he had a great, great skill for writing and for detail. And in this book, which you could think it's a bit boring, it's the story of this American Lebanese journalist who comes back and who wants to rebuild his family's ancestral home in this village, which is now kind of controlled by Hezbollah. But he describes like the mason, the neighbors, the curious neighbors. He, by just describing the village and the kind of Orwellian task it becomes to rebuild this house, he sums up the whole Middle East, how it's been divided, why people are bitter. All these things are in this book. And it's very sad because he also explains the relationship of this town to Syria and why after the Ottoman Empire, when things were divided, it kind of lost its raison d'être. And then he passed. He unfortunately died when he had an asthma attack when he was trying to go through the border of Turkey and Syria, which I thought was extremely sad. And I think he was a great journalist. He had a sense. He could, like Nahla, go east and west. Mm-hmm. He worked both ways. He understood both ways. And it's a very sensitive book that stays with you.
Carol Corm, thank you so much for joining us here on The Review.
Next, we'll be taking our weekly trip around the world with Nelly Gocheva, so don't go away.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
I don't even know what to think about that.
Take the Global Pulse.
I was at a bunga bunga party the other day.
And?
I wasn't at all. I just wanted to start a show like that. We're 187 shows down. How's your week been?
I'm feeling 187, actually.
And occasionally take things down a notch, too.
I had a pair of plum suede loafers with gold snaffles. And a guy stopped his car and leant out of the window and said it was people like me who were bringing this country to its knees.
To end the week with the best chat...
We know that he had them, and we know that he used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
Some great music.
Do you know, I never thought that I might need to have a question about death metal, but I'm warming up.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
You are listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian Tobias, and Emma Nelson.
It's time now to hand over to our associate editor, Nelly Gocheva, to hear some cultural treats she's dug out from around the world for us this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Francis Bacon is having a bit of a moment in Tokyo this weekend with his work on display at Takaishi Gallery in Minato-ku. Photography plays an important role in this exhibition, displaying 11 rare contact sheets that offer a glimpse into Bacon's creative process. The exhibition is on until the 6th of April. In London this weekend, the work of New York-based print artist Chuck Close is on display at the White Cube Gallery. The exhibition showcases over 150 works. Must-sees include the iconic large-scale portraits of composer Philip Glass and artist Lucas Samaras. The exhibition, entitled Chuck Close Prints, Process and Collaborations, is on until the 21st of April. This week marked the opening of the 20th annual Chicago Underground Film Festival, held in the city's Logan Theater. Several dozen films will be shown throughout the weekend, but we recommend Roddy Bugawa's Taken by Storm, a documentary about music album covers artist Storm Thorgerson. The man behind the design of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, and many more. For more information, go to cuff.org. Today is the fifth and final day of the Emirates Airline Literature Festival, featuring the latest works by 120 writers from 30 countries. The Literature Festival closes today at 1900 local time. And finally, on our playlist this weekend is Swedish four-piece band The Marijuanettes with their single Evil Coast. The album Hit the Waves is out on Monday. For Monaco, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
That was Evil Coast by The Marionettes, ending that report there by Nelly Gotcheva. Their new album, Hit the Waves, is out on Monday.
Time now for our weekly music review. Today we cross to Sydney. Our weekly musical guest this week is Linda Mariano, best known as a DJ on the famed Sydney radio station Triple J, where she hosts her show Good Night every weekday at 6 p.m, playing fresh music across the board. A very good evening to you, Linda. It is almost bedtime where you are, or is it almost going out time?
It's almost rave time. It's half past 11 at night, and there's always something going on. So today the Future Music Festival was on. So, you know, big people like we've got Rudimental from where you're from who are in town and doing big sets, and there's hilarious people like Psy. And yeah, it's a busy time of year as always.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about the music that you do. Tell me a little bit about your show, Good Nights.
Okay, so Good Nights is on weeknights on Triple J. So Triple J is, for people that don't know, it's national, so it's the Australia-wide youth nation. So we're aimed at 18 to 24-year-olds, and that's basically what we do. We just play new music releases. So I guess the equivalent might be kind of like Radio 1, but not quite as commercial. So with the show that I do, we just showcase new music releases every night. So we basically just, you know, trawl through blogs and find what we want to showcase, and we'll showcase one or two new Australian acts and then showcase overseas and international premieres and things like that. So that's what the day is every night for me.
How much of an emphasis do you place on Australian music when you're deciding what you're going to showcase?
Well, the show that I do is 3 hours every night, and we look to showcase like special acts. So we'll do like one new song an hour is the real big showcase. Two of those will be international. One of those will be Australian. So we'll always make sure that there's one big Australian in there that we're really talking up and that we're really promoting. And then the other ones can be from anywhere.
Linda, let's move to the first choice of what you wanted to play us today or tonight, or I don't know how to refer to you because we've got a big time difference. You wanted to talk to us about Freedom by Emma Louise. Tell us a bit more about that.
Emma Louise is one of my personal favourites in terms of female voices. We get a lot of like young, beautiful female singers that come to us from all across Australia, and Emma Louise was one that always stuck out to me anyway. She's from Cairns, which is a little city in like really northern Queensland, and she's just like this beautiful like blonde pixie girl with this angelic kind of honey voice.
I'm not sure I like it that much, the way you describe
it. Well, she's super young and she hasn't put out a record yet. She's just been posting up these demos online, and what Freedom is the first actual single from her debut album, which will be out in a couple of months' time.
Well, let's have a quick listen to it. This is Emma Louise and Freedom.
And that was Freedom there by Emma Louise. Linda, I'm interested in your work on radio. When I was in Venice, I was interviewing the people from Melbourne from Triple R Radio. And it seems that in Australia, there is still, even with the young people, a real connection to radio. So they're not just discovering their music online. They do connect still to radio. Do you find that?
I think so. It's really weird because it's such a... you know, with the way that technology's going, you just don't know whether there'll be a place for TV and for live radio anymore. And you think, well, you know, all you need to do is look on your laptop and you can follow blogs and you can follow people on Twitter and see what people are recommending. Like, why would you bother listening to the radio? And like, that's a scary thing. But what we've actually found is that people still want that company, and people still, like, as long as they like you and they like hearing you and they think that, you know, that you're fooling them into thinking that you're their friend, they actually still like having your company. And I think stuff like Twitter and like Facebook, as much as I was totally against like social networking at the start because it just scared the shit out of me, it really is the most amazing tool. Like, they can really connect one-on-one, and because of things like Twitter, you're literally just having this conversation still with these people that you're playing music to.
Linda, let's move on to the next choice that you've offered up to us today. This is Insane by Flume.
That was Insane from Flume. Linda, tell us a little bit about these musicians.
So Flume, I believe he was like touring overseas in the UK just recently. But he's basically just blown the hell up. Like, he's a 21-year-old producer. He's from Sydney. His name's Harley. And he put out this debut album. And we featured it on Triple J, which means that we, you know, showcased all the different tracks off it because we thought it was really great. And he has just absolutely blown up. Like, the album's gone to, I think it's gone to number one now, and he's been overseas doing a bunch of shows, and he's coming back here and starting out playing in almost stadium sizes. Like, people have just fallen in love with this guy over here. He's, you know, he's immensely talented, and it's a, I think he's fallen into this market that young people are really craving at the moment, which is that this cruisy electronic kind of hip-hop melting with trap music, melting with dance music, melting with this kind of beautiful, tender electronica has really hit this market that young people are just loving. So, yeah, people just can't get enough of it. Insane by Flume featuring Moon Holiday. Moon Holiday is another young singer from Sydney that that's just featuring on the record.
Linda, we're going to ask you to introduce your final track now. It's a three-piece indie electronica band with quite the knack for songcraft, you say. This is Rufus. Who? Tell us a little bit more about them.
Well, they're from Sydney as well. There are a few guys from Sydney. They put out an EP last year. They toured with the Presets. They've played with Royksopp. They're really kind of getting their little supporting notches on their belt, which is really cool. And that song, Take Me, I don't think it's even been properly released yet, but we played it. We did a premiere of it last Friday night on the show. It's Take Me. It's the first single from their debut album, Atlas. It's coming out mid-year. And the interesting thing about this, besides the fact that it's a really sweet, beautiful bit of indie dance music, is that it's going out through the Sweat It Out record label, which was formed by a guy called Adrian Thomas, who is Australia's number one DJ. His name is like DJ Ajax, and he passed away last week, tragically, in this traffic accident. But this Rufus single and album is the last thing that he worked on and put together with these young guys, and it was just this kind of, oh my God, this is the last thing he worked on, and it was meant to just come out, so let's throw it on the radio.
Linda Marigliano from Triple J Radio in Sydney, thank you very much indeed for joining us. We'll leave you to get on with your raving, and we'll take a listen to Rufus and Take Me. Take me away across the ocean. And that was Rufus there on Monocle 24, the choice of Linda Marigliano, who's the DJ on Triple J in Sydney. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
Time now for our weekly city look ahead, and today we journey to Singapore. Here's Justin Bergman to tell us what's happening there in the coming days.
Singapore's rainy season isn't really comparable to winter in London or New York, but the weather is wet enough to keep people indoors. Now, however, the rain is behind us, and Singapore's festival season is beginning. There are so many music, film, and performance festivals happening over the next month, in fact, Singaporeans are really spoiled for choice. One of the highlights next week is the Mosaic Music Festival, a 10-day concert series at the Esplanade, featuring big-name bands from overseas, such as Grizzly Bear and Joss Stone, as well as free performances by up-and-coming Singaporean artists. One of the more interesting local artists on the schedule is Charles J. Tan, a brooding, banjo-playing singer-songwriter who was born in Singapore but now lives in Melbourne. He'll be playing songs from his recently launched album Maybe Somewhere North. This song, Almost Sunday, was written by Tan during a lonely Christmas in Melbourne 5 years ago.
So I haven't been the best of friend.
Also performing at the festival is an electro-pop band with a unique name that may or may not refer to Singapore. I Hate This Place. The Singapore-based band, which has drawn comparisons to Postal Service, has been growing its fan base in Japan since the 2011 release of its latest album, Shiny One.
She never fit and she was living another life.
Of course, with the clear skies and rain-free nights, Singaporeans are returning to the beaches. And next week, the Tanjong Beach Club on Sentosa Island plays host to the first ever Art and Film Festival, which showcases art films and documentaries. On the program are 9 films, which will be shown on the beach with deck chairs and day beds set up for the audience. Meanwhile, over at the National University of Singapore, the annual NUS Arts Festival kicks off this weekend with a crowded schedule of dance, theater, and music performances featuring collaborations between Singaporean and international artists. The performances are intended to highlight individual members of the dance company who have traveled to the choreographers' home cities to work in their environments. For Monocle in Singapore, I'm Justin Bergman.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. Next up, we explore why you should be watching more Polish film.
The menu is Monocle 24's weekly look at good food, great drinks, and the makers behind these experiences. Each week, we serve up the latest in cuisine around the world, from top chefs to tiny breweries, and, of course, the best baristas.
Coffees that really stand out, that jump off the table, is what we're always looking for.
On the latest edition, we revisit the world's 50 Best Restaurants Awards in Singapore. We go to a Finnish restaurant with a Canadian twist in Thunder Bay, and we head to another restaurant in Madrid that is completely dedicated to cheese.
Spain has a long tradition of cheese makers. We got cheese dated around 400 years after Christ. We got more than 100 types of cheese all around Spain.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug. Welcome back. It's Saturday, so you must be listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson, and Gillian DeBias. Now, the Kinoteka Polish Film Festival, held across various locations in the United Kingdom, is now enjoying its 11th year. Its aim is to introduce a non-Polish audience to its country's cinematic riches. This year, the theme is classics to erotica. Here is a clip of one offering entitled Fuck for Forest.
I will keep going and I hope you do the same. Of breaking walls and borders.
Well, to tell us more, we're joined now in the studio by Roland Hojnowski, director of Kinoteka and head of the Polish Cultural Institute. Welcome to The Review.
A very good morning to you.
Good morning. To kick off, I wonder if you can talk to us a little bit. Is this a good time for a contemporary Polish cinema?
I think it's never been a better time than now, especially when we have so many Poles living in the United Kingdom and somehow they managed to seduce a British audience. And that's basically the history of Kinoteka. When we started 11 years ago and we made our first research, we noticed, we found out that about 70-80% of the audience were Polish expats. Although we were very few at that time here. Now, there are plenty of us here, but the proportion is sort of 50-50. So I would say that it's growing interest in Polish film and in Polish culture, generally speaking. Well, you want to know your neighbour much better.
Indeed, it's the second most spoken language in the United Kingdom now. That
surprised even us, I have to say.
Really? It did surprise you?
And yes, that. It will be a pleasure for me to offer you some free Polish lessons.
Which we will undoubtedly willingly take up, but we will obviously pay for them. That given, how do you start to introduce Polish cinema to a non-Polish audience?
Well, we don't start from the scratch. I would say that paradoxically the Polish cinema was relatively well known among people here, but I'm referring to the Polish cinema made by 1989, and that was a period when you could define the Polish film by basically two indicators: the overwhelming presence of politics and artistic ambitions. That's changed. 1989, that's the very important year in the Polish for the Polish film, but for the Polish history as such. Most of all, we didn't have to use anymore this Aesopian language full of metaphors to, you know, to fool the censor, the official censorship in our country. But it was also the beginning of the free market economy, and the Polish cinemas were flooded with American films, not necessarily the good ones. And we had a problem, how to carry on with good artistic films. And we managed to resolve this problem, I believe, and we are very proud that we set up an institute called Polish Film Institute, which is to some degree modeled on a French scenario, and they help very much the young producer or young film directors to make films with a bulky, quite generous budget. So that's very important. And now here back to Britain. Yes, in Britain we have Wajda, Skolimowski, the first films of Polański made in Poland, which are well known. And then, indeed, there is a kind of a generational gap, I would say. I'm very pleased that the Polish film has made a steady progress and is back on the international scene. Last year, Agnieszka Holland's In Darkness was nominated for the Oscar. This year, Małgosia Szumowska's In the Name at the Berlinale Film Festival got a Teddy Bear Award. She made a probably the very first Polish film dedicated entirely to the LGBT issues. And that's one of the last taboo and then Polish cinema.
Speaking of taboos, and you're talking about the fact that you have this generation gap when cinema had to follow a very careful path because of the censors. Do you feel as if the directors who are coming out now and the artists who are coming out now have an enormous amount of catching up to do?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, it doesn't sound maybe too modest, but we have very well prepared film directors who study, you know, everywhere in the world, and they have a very good background. The Łódź Film School is famous in the world, and you have quite a lot of names who studied there. So catching up maybe with some of the topics, you know, which were simply not allowed to be developed during the communist period. Yes. So, for example, we can even talk about the obsession of the Polish cinema now with the themes like Polish-Jewish relations during the German occupation and Holocaust, different minority issues. And here I would like to say a few words later maybe about my favorite film during this Kinoteka, which also treats the minority issue. But as I said, right now, I think that would be, it's very interesting for the British audience to get to know the other who is so close to you, and no taboo topics at all.
Well, let's talk about the festival. And I think you're mentioning one film, which I think we have a clip of. So perhaps we can listen to Rosa, and then you can talk a little bit about the film and then how it fits into the program of your festival.
Oh, my God, ich hatte Angst, dass uns kommen müssen.
Marco Wieter. Niemcy. Frau Kwiatkowski i jej córka zostały negatywnie zweryfikowane. Będą deportowane do Niemiec.
That was a clip of the film Rosa. It's quite an astonishing film, Roland. I'm sort of halfway through it and keep wanting to go back and go back and go back. It's the story of what? A widowed Polish Missourian, a group of people from a region in Poland whose identity is pretty much the main subject of this film. This man goes and helps a woman, a widow, in her farmhouse. He clears her field of mines so that she can grow potatoes on it in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. And it's an incredibly bleak film, but it's also a very complicated love story. I hope I've tried to describe what is a very, very deep, bleak, but rather tender film.
I think you're absolutely right, but let me quote one of the critics. That's not my words, but I like, because it's a very short description of the film, which I think says everything about it. It's an unbearably brutal yet hauntingly romantic film. And indeed, you can read this film at many different levels. The film basic plot, as you said, is a story about love built on ruins. We have this region in what is now northeastern Poland, before it was called as Eastern Prussia. It's the year 1945. It's a ferocious time. And Róża, or Rose in English, is the main character. We don't really know whether she is Polish or German. She's simply Mazurian. She speaks both languages and a dialect. And let me make a little digression about, historical digression, because I think hardly anyone heard in this country about the Mazurians. Well, that's the indigenous people of this region, once again, Eastern Prussia, Northeastern Poland, which has been going through a Germanization process since 13th century. And then after the end of the World II, through the Polonization process. So basically they became victims of two powerful nationalisms, and
they were hated for being Polish by the Germans, and they were hated for being German by the Poles.
Sometimes they were considered to be Germans, and sometimes they were considered to be Poles, and the other way around. You know, everything was depended on the political situation. But the historical fact is that most of them supported Hitler and Germans during the Second World War and before. But Róża itself is a widow. Her husband, a German soldier, is killed at the end of the Second World War, and the witness of his death decides to come to her and to tell her about the last minutes of her husband's life. And, you know, you have this very interesting and powerful interaction between both two characters. First, they are united by what I would call the biological impulse of survival, and then love comes. So this is a love story film. True. This is a story about the history about the Mazurians. But what is very often missed in different reviews, and I think it's very important, you can interpret this film also through gender theory. And we have so many war films where you have evil and good men. And this time, it's for the first time, well, I don't know many films like this, where you can see the war, the atrocities of the war, through the eyes of a woman.
It seems a very, very brutal film, very harsh, but very tender. But it seems, looking at the trailer, that the cinematography is so important to the storytelling. And of course, Polish films have a rich tradition of cinematography. Is that now as important with the contemporary filmmakers, do you think?
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is a tradition, I think one of the best tradition of the Polish film. We always ask ourselves, what is the best part of Polish film industry? It was the worst one. And we have very good operators, we have very good composers. We had a problem with dialogues, so to say, with scenarios, but this film, I think, is perfect in any at every level. So really, if I may make this publicity here, so Riverside Studio and Rose, it's almost sold out, but I checked the reports too this morning, especially for you. There are apparently 12 seats.
But the film is also distributed all around the world, so people...
It is an issue that Gillian has just touched on there. I mean, the performances in the film are astonishing, and it is one of those amazing films that you think this deserves to have absolutely the best worldwide attention possible. Going back to the issue of sort of promoting Polish film across the world, how big a problem has the issue of distribution been, and what's being done to ensure that films like Róża will be seen by a world audience?
Well, that's a very interesting topic, and I think it depends what countries have you got in mind. I think that as we are at here and we are speaking in English, you have in mind mostly the Anglo-Saxon countries, and that's a very difficult market, very demanding market, mainly because your own production is so huge. So it's not something characteristic only for foreign films, foreign language films, but also for non-English language culture as such. You know, I like to give people this example that when we are talking, for example, about literature and translation, and in sort of average European country, 50% of the French, German, Swedish, 60% of the Polish market, that's translations, in England, that's only 3%. And half of this 3% are translations from the French. So that gives you how difficult it is for a non-English authors or film directors to enter the English language market.
Do you think there's also a job of breaking down stereotypes? Because so many Polish films have been very art house, and so the perception from maybe a general public of cinema goers might be that you have to break down these films, that they can be enjoyable, engaging, and not necessarily all very hard to swallow.
Well, it is a good question, but it depends how we classify or how you define the stereotype of the Polish cinema, because as I said, I think it's I don't know what's the stereotype of the Polish cinema. Old classics, what does it mean? Yes, we were obsessed, like most of the Central European nations, with history, politics, and literature. Great Polish films, that's the adaptation of our great novels. But what is the perception of the British viewers? That's something which puzzles us till now. We simply don't know yet.
Roland Chojnacki, director of Kinoteka and head of the Polish Cultural Institute, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And if you're in the United Kingdom, Kinoteka will be running in London, Liverpool, Belfast and Edinburgh until the 17th of March. If not, just go to kinoteka.org.uk for more details to find out where you can find it where you are. That brings us to the end of today's Saturday Review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our thanks to our producer Katie Bilboa, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexa Feminesh, our studio manager too, Toby Hammond.
We're handing over back to Georgina for the weekend edition, where you can hear our best picks of everything on Monocle 24.
But from now, for me, Emma Nelson
and Gillian Tobias,
goodbye and thank you very much for listening.